Thank you so much for that nice introduction, and thank you also for the invitation to speak to the group at the Foundation for Science and Technology. It's an honor, and I appreciate the opportunity. As mentioned, I have had a long career in, and primarily in, science diplomacy, multilateral and also bilateral science diplomacy. And whereas the previous speakers were very detail-oriented about the UK, I'm going to pull back, maybe look at the other end of the telescope, and speak of really science diplomacy from the US perspective, and the larger picture of the opportunities and responsibilities of being a, I know it's a loaded word now, as soon as you get colonialism linked with super science power, it's a bit loaded, but being a heavyweight in the science and research world. As you know, the United States government places significant importance on scientific endeavors, and it does invest more than, I believe, any other country in research and development. We also recognize, however, that technical expertise, the knowledge, the resources go far beyond our borders. In fact, science is a global endeavor, and you'll hear me say that a few times. International cooperation in science is as vital as ever. You know, as all of our borders, our information borders become more and more porous, science is it's a shared act. We collaborate with scientists all over the world on everything from high energy physics to stem cells. And we see science diplomacy and using science globally as a way to build bridges with other peoples and communities. So international science and technology cooperation is definitely a focus for the Biden administration. It's a major pillar of how we view foreign affairs. Science and technology is a core part of our diplomacy planning and practice. And I think it's safe to say that research and science is core to our decision making. But as I mentioned, there are opportunities and responsibilities that come with being that science superpower. Science is a global endeavor, not only in the making of the science, but also in the fact that science has the power to mitigate global crises, pandemic, climate change. It lifts economies, which is, I think, what that leveling up piece is all about. And it improves people's lives throughout the world. Science diplomacy is about recognizing and facilitating the opportunities and being mindful of the responsibilities that come with being that science superpower. With that in mind, the State Department has a number of programs that aim to share our science with scientists and government partners that are up and coming. So I'm going to pull on my experience, having been director of our Office of Science and Technology Cooperation, with some examples of how we have handled this. One is our Science Envoys program. And this is where we pull some science superstars from the academic community, and we anoint them as envoys. For example, Peter Hotez was a science envoy, as was Jane Lubchenco, just to name two that come to mind from my past. And they are just that, they're volunteer envoys. We support them for a year or two so that they can go out and they can talk about their passion, their science, they can develop programs. Peter Hotez spent a lot of time in Egypt. Others go to Vietnam, Azerbaijan. In fact, Peter Hotez said, if I can quote him, becoming a US science envoy offers an incredible opportunity to explore the themes of science and vaccine diplomacy as a component of US foreign policy. So this is a really important way of energizing other countries and empowering the science and the decision making in their governments by sharing our superstars with them, basically. We also have Science Fellow Program, and these are working scientists from our government agencies, whether it's the Department of Energy, Environmental Protection Agency, and they join us at embassies for 6 weeks or so, bringing their area of expertise with them. We had an embassy fellow from the Department of Energy who worked on quantum issues here in London, not just before COVID. And she made a lot of contacts, she deepened a lot of connections, and I believe that collaboration is still occurring. We also have exciting programs on science and technology, science entrepreneurs, basically, S&T entrepreneurs. These are young, new researchers and scientists or just individuals who've developed some kind of cool thing. And we coach them, we find mentors for them, we have competitions, and it's just a way of sharing some of our wealth in that entrepreneurship area with in emerging economies with young scientists. I went to a really exciting program in Tunisia where a young woman, the winner of the competition was, you know, an 18-year-old Tunisian woman who beat out a lot of more experienced men in that case. But of course, responsibility and opportunity are intertwined, and that relationship is perhaps best captured in our support of the bilateral science and technology agreements that we have, dozens of them. And these are umbrella agreements where we come, you know, we negotiate and come to some agreement on intellectual property rights and the overarching scenarios that guide our research exchanges and all the other details that goes into the sausage making of science. Negotiating these it's slow going because we don't only speak for our government scientists and agencies, but also for academics throughout. For example, I remember negotiating with one country, you know, what happens when you get a young exchange student that goes to country X with, you know, some kernel of an idea and some significant sophisticated technique and then shares it with that university scientists. If something happens, and then who owns that IP? So these are the kinds of things we try and hammer out beforehand. I'm sure you have much more experience with this than I do. And of course, you know, we had our bout with Horizon and trying to figure out how our funded scientists could collaborate well with the Horizon 2020 at that time funded scientists. But, you know, we managed to work something out. And that brings in that sort of that government issue. One of the issues one of the advantages of the science and technology umbrellas is that we do have the opportunity then to meet with our bilateral partners. And oftentimes these science and research ministries, the ministries that cover those issues or fund academia, are not, let's face it, the most powerful ministries in these governments. So having the U.S., and in the, you know, the UK, I'm sure you have similar things at the table with these scientists and ministry folks responsible. It lends a lot of credibility and starts to empower that whole scientific enterprise in the minds of the ministries that will fund the science and research. So it lifts everything up. So these large, the relationships, whether they're people to people or government to government, are important because we're caretakers of the scientific enterprise. That's part of that responsibility and the opportunity. But our job is to ensure that we have an ethical and level playing field where there's common understanding on the conduct of ethical science, from funding the research to reporting and publishing. So let me quickly pivot to the sort of global 20,000 foot to something more specific, which is our relationship with the UK. Obviously, the UK is probably our premier partner on science and technology. We share what I just mentioned, that belief in the power of science and technology to improve health and prosperity and security and a shared commitment as well to the importance of investigator-driven research and freedom of inquiry. For centuries, science has been the foundation of our special relationship, and probably that's another word expression that's a bit overused, but it's so true for the U.S. and the U.K. And in fact, it probably began with Benjamin Franklin's correspondence with the Royal Society on electricity, but I have a feeling it's gone even farther back than that. The U.K. and U.S. are two research powerhouses. It's another expression one can use. Our scientists have won an impressive 358 Nobel Prizes, and between us, we host all of the world's top 10 universities. Working together has produced many tangible impacts, and just recently, two Americans and a British scientist won the 2020 Nobel Prize. So it's clear that we both value our unique expertise, partnering and working together across geographical and disciplinary boundaries. I think one of the great things is as we take our enduring special relationship forward, we're better positioned than anywhere else in the world to turn that research into new technologies that can change the world and grow our economies. And it's for this reason that the United States and the United Kingdom agreed to update our science and technology cooperation just last year. In the new Atlantic Charter that came out of the G7 meeting in Cornwall, the US and the UK resolved to harness and protect our innovative edge in science and technology to support our shared security and deliver jobs at home, to promote the development and deployment of new standards and technologies to support democratic values, and to continue to invest in research into the biggest challenges facing the world. Building off of that resolve, excuse me, the US and the UK further agreed to develop a landmark science and technology partnership to strengthen the valued UK-US relationship and, of course, create those jobs. It's all about that leveling up and protecting the security, which includes, obviously, the security of knowing that the global challenges and crises of that the world faces are being addressed together, because anyone's crisis affects our security. That's part of being citizens in that global world. It aims to strengthen cooperation in areas such as the resilience and security of critical supply chains, battery technologies, emerging technologies, including artificial intelligence, and improve accessibility and the flow of data to support economic growth. Perhaps one of the strongest examples of science undergirding and forcing a direction for policy is climate science. Simply put, we would not have been able to make the achievements that we did at COP26, the progress on national commitments, on the methane pledge, for example, and others, if there had not been overwhelming consensus on the climate science. Scientists have warned for decades that with the speed of human-related warming, extreme weather events such as heat waves and storms and wildfires, et cetera, would become more common, and the world would become a more volatile and dangerous place to live. And we are certainly seeing that play out in spades. But if it weren't for the persistence of scientists, our activists, and ultimately our politicians and citizens would not have been able to leverage the now settled science and use that science to gain some momentum in tackling the crisis. It's how science persevered and really persevered until you got into the heads of the decision makers and policy makers. At COP26, we saw the implementation of S&T initiatives that aid in tackling those climate challenges. Clean energy transitions around the world. The U.S. launched Net Zero World to marshal the 17 U.S. national laboratories and provide critical technical assistance to key partner countries. In addition, the U.S. and United Arab Emirates actually led the launch for the Agriculture Innovation Mission for Climate, which counts 80 partners in many countries and billions of dollars to advance climate smart agriculture and food systems for innovation. So to wrap it up, as the UK focuses on its ambitions on science domestically, the US is ready and willing to continue our long history, Benjamin Franklin, of partnership with all of you, not only bilaterally, but together as world leaders in using science to solve the critical challenges ahead for humans, for nature, and for the planet. Thank you very much.